Hi, welcome to another edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm an EMS instructor with Inver Hills Community College. I'm here with
Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Dr. Aaron Burnett, I'm an EMS fellow with Regents Hospital EMS.
Josh Salzman, the director of critical care research at Regents Hospital in St. Paul.
And Dr. Keith Wesley, I'm the medical director here at Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul.
So we are going to discuss ETCO2, a predictive tool for excluding metabolic disturbances in non-intubated patients. This is a project, a paper by Dr. Kartal and company, and it was published here just very, very recently, I believe February 2011, in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. And I think we are all excited about this paper. Probably the company that sells end-tidal CO2 devices is going to be even more excited about this, because I think our perception of capnography has been a confirmation of endotracheal intubation, and then waveform capnography for COPD and assessment of COPD and difficulty breathing. However, this paper looked at whether or not the values of those of that end-tidal CO2, that non-invasive side stream, if you will, value, would give us some window of prediction to possibly mortality, but more importantly and more interestingly, metabolic acidosis. And so, for the first time, I think, in my career, when I think of making the lists of H's and T's that ACLS has always asked me to do, and I always think about, you know, AEIOU tips, all the reasons people could be unconscious or have a seizure, and I put acidosis down, I've really never known exactly how I would know that, how I would measure that. So for the first time, we have one of our tools in our tool bag being looked at for potentially a purpose that may turn out to be very, very interesting. So the way that they structured this study is they took a cohort of patients that came into their particular emergency department, and they said, okay, we're going to look at anybody getting arterial blood gases is also going to get an end-tidal CO2 reading. It's fairly cleanly done. It was prospective, so it's a nice cross-sectional study. And what they looked at was they're going to exclude anybody who was getting arterial blood gases for COPD. We're going to just get rid of any patients that had a pulmonary reason, because that complicates things, and I think they were right to do so. They're just looking at why they were checking for metabolic acidosis. And for those patients, compared the end-tidal CO2, the readings from the capnography, to bicarbonate level in the arterial blood gas. Their conclusion is that those values do correlate moderately with bicarb levels and might predict mortality, possibly. So jump in anytime, everybody. I think my feeling is that it's a well-done study. It was prospectively done, and I was very interested in some of the curves that they showed, although I felt kind of out of my league to understand the surface area underneath the curve and the math that was involved with trying to compare those two. I also think we have to talk about sensitivity and specificity with these tests, as you know, just to use an example that might be more easily understood by us field paramedics is maybe, or at least I think of it as, you know, when you do a 12 lead EKG, if the machine calls it a STEMI, boy oh boy, there's, you know, nearly 100% specificity that is a STEMI. But you might miss a lot of MIs that don't present with ST elevation, so it's not 100% sensitive. Excuse me. So in this particular case, there's a good discussion about sensitivity versus specificity, and I wonder if anybody wants to comment about that.
You know, this. Sure. I was going to talk about something else. So maybe I'll go there first. I think this is an exciting paper. It's an exciting paper because, you know, Medigrigs all over the country have end title in them now. And like Dave said, we think of that as a way to confirm endotracheal tube placement, and it certainly is. But this paper is now showing us that that tool can be expanded to tell us so much more about our patients. It can tell us information that previously required a blood gas to be done in the hospital. And we don't have to buy any new equipment to do this. We already have it. And we can gain so much more information about our patients from using things we already have. Now, to go to the specificity and the sensitivity question, the easy way to think about it for me is that if you have something that's highly specific and that test is positive, that means you probably got what it's telling you about. If you have a test that's very sensitive and that test is negative, it's a pretty good sign that something's not going on. So that's how I think of it. Some of these research terms can get confusing as we go forward, so I try to break things down to the bare bones, pre-hospital, emergency doc level.
So to cut to the chase here, we have if the ETCO2 value is 25 or less, then there's a high likelihood that this patient is going to be acidotic. And if the value is above 37 millimeters of mercury, you've ruled out an acidosis, and bicarb levels are 100% likely to be above 21. So the fact that it's high tells you the patient is not acidotic, and the fact that it's low tells you, well, it's fairly certain with an 84% kind of sensitivity or specificity that we're going to actually be acidotic.
And so that's important in this study. The fact that the CO2 being low is what correlates with acidosis is a key point. If you sort of think about the chemistry behind CO2 and bicarb, that's a little counterintuitive, but that's why they excluded the COPD patients in this study. That's why they focused on just metabolic acidosis, not respiratory acidosis. Those are two different things, completely different. And so I think excluding the COPD patients was a great thing because it allowed us to focus in on the cases where we have a metabolic acidosis, your DKA patients, your aspirin overdoses, lactic acidosis from septic shock. Those are the patients who, when they become acidotic, their body tries to compensate and blow that acid off by breathing faster. Their respiratory rate's going to increase, and in doing that, they get rid of the carbon dioxide. But as they breathe faster, every individual breath has less carbon dioxide, and that's what you're going to measure with your end title. You're going to measure a low CO2, which means a high acid content of the blood.
I think of it like there's a raging fire of metabolism in the body, and the byproduct of fire is smoke. Smoke is your end title CO2. And the more you breathe that out, the more you're blowing out all that smoke. You're venting the smoke out of your body. And because you vent it out, it gets lower and lower. And so when we arrive and we're measuring that, it's less, the number is less.
And I'm going to agree with you guys up to this point that this is a valuable study. But as much as I congratulate them on excluding the COPDs to exclude the respiratory acidoses, the fact that 49% of their patients were in acute renal failure, I believe added a group of individuals with deranged bicarbonate metabolism. Now, they define it as acute renal failure, but how do you really know what's acute, what's subacute, and the bicarb in the acute renal failure? I would like to see this done with excluding the acute renal and deal with those patients like you're talking about, Dr. Burnett, that are, you know, you would expect with a sudden onset of some type of insult, such as sepsis, infection, heart failure, diabetes, the body will start to deal with the acidosis, but with internal bicarb. The patient in renal failure already has an impaired ability to generate bicarb. So it may actually, you know, by excluding one, they actually have added another error. And I think that may actually explain why the agreement between the end-tidal CO2 and the serum bicarb isn't as close as what you would think, because most of us, you know, we talk about capnography. We say, all right, if you have a CO2 level of 35, then what's your serum bicarb? Well, it ought to be 35. Well, actually not. And in fact, if you have a end-tidal CO2 of, at least in this study, if you have an end-tidal CO2 of somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, 30, then your serum bicarb could be anywhere between 35 and 25. Well, that's a big difference, you know. And so, my question is, by including their acute renal failure patients in this study, did that increase that degree of lack of congruence?
You know, I think their paper is short on the paragraph that deals with limitations is pretty short. I think they kind of they could have done a little bit better job of explaining some of the other limitations. For one, I would have loved to known how many of these patients were on oxygen.
Well, and the other issue is what's selection bias. They only did this study on those patients who had a clinical indication for a blood gas.
Right.
And so, okay, you get a blood gas, we do end-tidal CO2.
So by definition, they already are probably sick and have some change in their metabolism, metabolic rate.
What group of DKA patients do we do blood gases on anymore? Nobody. Only the ones who, despite aggressive therapy in the ER, just seem to not be getting better. And then you finally go, all right, maybe I need to throw some bicarb in there. But we don't routinely do blood gases on DKA.
You know, one area I think this could be helpful, we have several services under our medical direction who have quite long transport times, 45 minutes on a snowy winter day here in Minnesota, up over an hour. And that's a period of time where I think using this end title, you could actually start to see some of your interventions paying off. You could have, for instance, your DKA patient who's sick, and you know that. The end title is not telling you they're sick. You don't need a machine. You're an experienced clinician. But as you rehydrate them, as they get to 4, maybe 5 liters of fluid over that hour transport, you see their end title creeping up from 15 to 18 to 22 by the time you get to the hospital. And that'll tell you you're moving that patient in the right direction. It'll reassure you that even though you're given all this fluid, it's the right thing to do. It'll give you a sense of how your patient is responding to your treatment during your transport time.
It is kind of a window into the metabolic state. You're sort of seeing a little bit of a window into metabolism. And while this isn't 100% one-to-one correlated, it is kind of telling you early detection. And I really liked that paragraph, part of the paper, where they're sort of saying, you know, if we alert ourselves or alert if EMS can alert the hospital, if the ER can alert the next caregiver and aggressively begin treating acidosis, then it seems to me very similar to what's happening with sepsis. It seems to be similar to what's happening with STEMI, that we can sort of perk our ears up a little bit more. And it may not mean that they're acidotic. It may not mean that they're really that sick. But we shouldn't ignore these numbers anymore. We shouldn't just go, oh, look, it's low. That's just sort of, it's there. I think, at least in my experience, when I bring a patient in that's on end-tidal CO2, I think usually they just take it off. And the docs and the nurses just look at me like, oh, well, okay, not anything I'm really going to do anything about. So for the first time, I felt like this is more than just sort of taking a look at, you know, shark fin shaped waves or whether or not there was, you know, whether we just, it's there, but looking at a little bit finer granularity about it.
Well, you know, I think end-tidal CO2 is one of the several areas where pre-hospital providers are really leading the state of the science. They're really defining the frontiers of how we care for patients. We always think of it happening in the hospital, in the ED, in the research labs, but I think this paper is a great example of how when you bring your patient to the emergency department, you might have to explain to the doc, or if they're a good doctor and they don't understand, they'll come ask you, can you explain to me why you did this end title? What question were you trying to answer? And this paper gives you a little bit of ammunition to come back on. We were concerned about their metabolic state. We thought they might be acidotic. So I think this is, knowing how to use end title is going to empower you to deal with your patients in a way that we don't even do very well on the in-hospital side.
I also think this is a paper that I would bring to your medical director, especially if you don't have capnography for non-intubated patients. I think a lot of systems do not purchase those side stream either nasal cannulas or the sensors that are meant for patients who are breathing. They capture the patient who's intubated, but really don't spend the extra bucks on the nasal cannula. And to be truthful, I'm not sure how much those cost, but I'll bet you anything that it costs less than the arterial blood gas. And so here we go once again with a fairly non-invasive procedure that EMS can do that we may have to foot the bill for or pass along to the patient that might save some money later, maybe. Any other thoughts or comments just about, I found some of the discussion very interesting, and I really direct you to look at some of the other studies that this particular group quoted. Because this is not the first time that somebody has looked at the correlation between end-tidal CO2 and acidosis and metabolism. So I'd highly encourage you to pull those other papers and keep track of this as it develops. Obviously, we need more studies, and we need to be looking, especially because of the latest recommendations on oxygen administration and the fact that increased oxygen can increase acidosis. I'd really like to see a pre-hospital study that shows correlation here and that really controls for how much oxygen patients are getting. We definitely, ETCO2, as they comment here, and I'm quoting, ETCO2 can represent decreased minute volume, minute ventilation, and or an increase in metabolic states. And so both of those things, you know, those are findings from previous papers that make us think, boy, there's something more interesting in this particular venue. Thanks again for tuning in to this edition of the PCRF podcast.